Here we go, folks. Another episode of Positively Trek with me, Dan Gunther, and my wonderful co-host, Barry DeFord, talking Trek and continuing our Star Trek Prodigy discussion this week. Barry, how are you doing?
I am extremely wonderful. Thank you very much for asking, Mr. Dan. I'm quite happy to be getting a little bit more time to kind of flesh out some of the things that we spoke about in Star Trek Prodigy. I found as we talked, more things kept coming up, and as I've said a number of times, a lot of things happened in this series that are worth more conversation. So very excited to keep this one going. How about yourself?
For sure. I'm doing really well. Really kind of oddly enjoying this very short kind of fallow period of Star Trek. You know, we're getting so much new Star Trek, and I'm sure once Picard starts, it's going to just continue at a breakneck pace once again. So it's kind of nice to have this little break right now, and we can kind of just relax and reflect on what we just saw and look ahead with giddy anticipation to what's coming on the horizon. So yeah, I'm pretty excited.
Yeah, it's remarkable to think in that respect that what 2009 is 15 years ago, and
wow.
We were coming off of a very long unwanted break from Star Trek. And that's pretty neat that now we're kind of at another side of that, the other side of the coin, where it is actually, you're right, kind of nice to kind of slow down, catch up a little bit, just do that sort of stuff. That's nice.
Well, before we get to the Prodigy discussion, we do have to talk about some news. And we're talking about, of course, the huge amounts of Star Trek, 5 series on right now, one of which is going to be ending soon, though. But that is not to say that there aren't going to be more series to come and replace it, because once again, on the heels of Michelle Yeoh's star rising with these accolades and her wonderful performance this past year in Everything Everywhere All at Once, winning the Golden Globe for that, Paramount is rushing to assure us Star Trek Section 31 is still in development with Michelle Yeoh in that lead role. So I thought the timing of this was really interesting, just kind of them sticking their hands up and saying, hey, no, we're still doing this. We're still doing it. We swear. I have yet to hear Michelle Yeoh say that, which I would love to hear at some point. But I don't know. What are your thoughts on all of this and the timing and the how likely is it we're going to see this series anytime soon?
Michelle Yeoh has and always will be a force of nature in the way she acts and in the way she carries and composes herself. And I mean, I think back to when I was first introduced to her in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, easily one of my most favorite movies of all time for its, at the time, kind of an otherworldliness. It's actually helped spark an interest in China that I have all the way up until this very day. Getting to see her, you know, put on the Starfleet uniform, lose it very suddenly, and get a whole brand new take on her character, I think that was sort of while she was on this kind of second resurgence of her fame, and we were able to catch her at a good time. And I'm assuming the folks over at Paramount are counting their lucky stars that they probably have something in ink that says that she needs to act for them. Because at this point, I think booking Michelle Yeoh would be a little bit difficult, shall we say. Buhawitsu, it cannot be helped, would have been what they would have said in that respect. So I'm pretty excited that we are likely going to see Michelle Yeoh come back and reprise her role. That'll be really wonderful because she knows how to steal the spotlight in a lot of ways.
Yeah, definitely. As far as the series itself goes, I mean, we don't know a lot about it except for the title and the fact that Michelle Yeoh is set to lead it. I'm in any case just really curious with that setup we got in Discovery and her stepping through the Guardian of Forever with I actually kind of always laugh a little bit at the dialogue in this scene where Carl, the personification of the Guardian of Forever, is totally giving like the pitch for a series where he's like, you'll meet new characters and you'll have new adventures and it won't all be blah. I'm like, Okay, this is very fourth wall breaking here. I feel like I'm in an elevator with the writers and I'm a producer and they're giving me the pitch here.
And so will might come along to help sometimes. Yeah, no, you're right.
Exactly.
And it was supposed to be this very heartfelt moment, right? That whole piece. I don't know. If it happens, it's good. I guess like you're right, like we have a glut of Star Trek coming anyways, so I'm not again in any like serious like rush and stuff. I know some people really like Section 31. Obviously, I'm a fan of Michelle Yeoh's, but make sure you've got that contract handy because I think she might be hard to book.
Well, let's move on to another corner of the Star Trek universe on television, Star Trek Lower Decks. We had a recent interview with Mike McMahon on the Trek Talks 2 fundraiser event, and some hints here and there as to what's going on with season 4, for good or for ill, depending on some of your, you know, opinions on season 3, which overall I really loved. There's one episode, though, that I think is, I've seen people love it, and I've seen people absolutely loathe it, and I haven't seen a lot of in between.
Is it the bird one?
It's the bird one. A mathematically perfect redemption with and I'm putting in these quotes are doing a lot of heavy lifting here, the fan favorite Peanut Hamper. And Peanut Hamper apparently is coming back at some point.
Oh man.
So I don't know how people are gonna feel about that.
The high concept self-indulgence of that episode is just I guess it's like we panned George Lucas when he just decided to start finger painting with his own you might have to bleep that out but this was 100% the writers just finger painting the most bizarre story about trying to say, look at how much of a jerk Peanut Hamper is. She's probably a sociopath, you know, like that kind of whole.
Probably. Like,
well, that's the thing is it's, I just, but the screaming, just all of the screaming and like this like weird, almost kind of like, you know what it reminded me of was actually the battle for Endor. It was very similar in its trying to be this huge thing, but it, I don't know, it kind of went like a mile wide and an inch deep, like just sort of like, because that was the end. They just had to tumble to the end to be like, yeah, Peanut Hamper's a real jerk, and that's it. So, but I'd love to see Peanut Hamper again. We have all, like, I guess the only thing that that episode does is it gives us the ability and gives the writers, it gives us the ability to laugh at it and gives the writers, like, so much material to have us laugh at now, because they're going to have a lot of fun with that whole weird episode.
The one thing that does excite me about Peanut Hamper's return is that will surely be also the return of Agamus, voiced by Jeffrey Combs, that we saw, you know, Peanut Hamper teaming up with at the end there. So that has me excited. I mean, you know, that wasn't... a mathematically perfect redemption. I do have to applaud it just for like the ambition, I guess, to just go for it and put it on. Like, okay, wow, they just did that. Okay, wow.
I'm not going to say they didn't hit the mark with it, but it is kind of like, I don't know. I'm a big fan of music. I love music. And actually, if you can find them, there's another podcast out there called No Dogs in Space, and it's hosted by a guy named Marcus Parks and Carolina Hidalgo. They're a husband and wife duo who come from their own like podcasting pedigree. They are both professionals and good in their own rights. And you can find out what else they do otherwise elsewhere. But they talk about like when sometimes stars like zig when they should have zagged, and sometimes it works and sometimes it's absolutely catastrophic. And then other times you're just kind of like, oh, huh. And you kind of move on. I feel like it is that sort of idea of like a band that we've sort of seen. They've kind of got this whole idea and then they just come out with this completely different concept once and then maybe never even return to it ever again. I think that's kind of what happened here is they just sort of decided that they wanted to let loose.
Yeah. I'm kind of interested to watch it again. Just, I don't know. I've kind of avoided it, but just to see, because I don't know. There's, I think they accomplished whatever it was they were trying to accomplish with it.
Absolutely.
I just, I'm not, I don't know. I can't say much more.
It's very high concept. Just right. You gotta think of it as that very, it's up there in terms of high concept with, it's reminiscent of The Inner Light in the sense that it really just isn't about Star Trek at all. And then, you know, the character comes to some great realization, right? Picard realizes the value of life itself and about making the most of the world you're in and the people you're with and all that sort of stuff. And Peanut Hamper learns that she can use people to her advantage.
Yeah. Well, moving on to some of the other clues that McMahon dropped about season four. We've got an amazing episode where we go to Orion. Mm-hmm. That's exciting. I'm excited to see that. I mean, you know, Tendi content is always very welcome. Mm-hmm. There's a very romantic episode. It's almost like a Valentine's Day episode, but I'm not going to reveal if kissing happens in it because it will give away what happens. That's very cryptic. I can't figure that one out, but I'm interested. And then there's a wedding in season four. Brace yourself. Get on your Worf wedding attire and look forward to that. The wedding of the season is coming. Shax and T'Ana, maybe? Or...
I guess, like, I do also appreciate how they have kind of broken convention in certain cases. I think originally you would have seen the relationships fall in certain binaries and in certain ways. And in this case, we're not really seeing it that way. And I like that. I guess, honestly, with Lower Decks, I've kind of always taken the show very much as it comes. It's been fun. It's enjoyable. I never really got into Rick and Morty very much. And so seeing this whole take on it, like originally people were, I think, were thinking that it was just going to be that cartoon with the Star Trek skin, but it's really come into its own. It's able to do high concept stuff like we've seen. So all of those things could also be some kind of funny gotcha too, right? Like, who knows, right? Peanut Hamper might get married to Boimler. Who knows? Like that could 100% actually happen. And then that would just be just juice for more jokes in the future that, like, there would be these hangups where Boimler was married to Peanut Hamper. So he had to go and do something else, right? Like,
yeah. Absolutely. Well, the other thing that I'm loving about season four is it's going to be the most T'Lyn-filled season. And T'Lyn was a character who popped in season two, and then we got her joining the Cerritos right at the end of season three. And I love this character. I'm with, like, the majority of fans out there, it seems, that just for whatever reason love this Vulcan. And I'm excited to see her interact with the crew and play off of Tendi's boundless enthusiasm.
Yeah, they'll make good character foils to each other in a lot of ways. I really, really like Tendi. I'd actually say that Tendi's probably my favorite character in Lower Decks. There's a bit of a doe-eyed sweetness to her, but I think you can also tell in a lot of ways she is a very careful construction of herself in the sense that I think she could very easily be something else, and she is deciding to be good. And she's, everyone's like, oh, Tendi, you're just so sweet. And she's like, every now and again at these moments where she's like, no, I'm choosing to be this nice. I really like being nice and I choose it. And I wonder if maybe that might get challenged a little bit this way through, where people always expect Tendi's sweetness and charm to come through. But maybe sometimes when it's taken for granted, she just decides to turn the other side just to be like, here's what you might get. You should appreciate the way I act.
Kind of thing. Well, especially with that trip to Orion, you know, that could really be something, because we've seen when she's around other Orions, there is this other life that she's left behind, like you're saying there.
Yeah. So, she really bristles at that thought of being an Orion too, right?
Yeah, and I with Tendi, I respond really strongly to passion and enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why, one of the reasons I love that character so much. So she kind of arrives on the Cerritos and acts the way I would if I was stepping onto a Federation starship, right?
100%.
So speaking of Lower Decks, we've got a nomination for an Annie Award, which is from the International Animated Film Society. The Lower Decks season three finale, The Stars at Night, was nominated for Best Editorial. So that's pretty cool. Nice little racking up of a nomination there. And we also have nominations for Discovery for NAACP and GLAAD Awards, which I, you know, anytime I see Star Trek on the list for consideration by those groups, I get pretty happy. Like, that's the right thing to happen, I think.
It means we're on the side of the angels, and I just really want to put my foot solidly down there that recognizing Black, Indigenous, people of color, people who express their inborn nature and identify with the LGBTQ community and the people who see themselves as allies, this is what we expect in our entertainment. This is not something that we're happy to see. This is something that we can be happy to see, but this is not something that should be surprising. I think as much as I value it and want it to continue, I think to some degree we should be talking about this and we should be bringing this up. And I guess, like, I don't know, I don't want to gloat or anything like that, but at the same time, it feels pretty good, and it makes me very happy that Star Trek has, again, much like Tendi, chosen this direction, and I think it has a lot to do with the fan base and our influence in that regard.
Yeah, and for example, for the GLAAD Award for Outstanding Drama Series that it's being nominated for, I love the idea, and there's kind of an inherent competition when it comes to awards. For example, this article on TrekMovie.com says it's going up against 9-1-1, Lone Star, Chucky, Good Trouble, Gossip Girl, Grey's Anatomy, The L Word, Generation Q, P-Valley, September Mornings, and The Umbrella Academy. I would reword that slightly to say it's not going up against them. It's honored to be included amongst this group. And one of them's going to win, but, you know, just recognizing this amazing, huge group of shows that are finally kind of representing humanity in the colorful ways that humanity is, you know, like, I love that. I think that's great. And that Star Trek is among them, finally, right?
It's important to be at the table at this and to be there as a supporter of all of that is really important to me. And, you know, obviously there's sometimes people say, like, well, you know, marketing is not the same as emancipation and representation is not the same as liberation. I would 100% agree with that and see that. But the good part is those people, those would-be liberators who are growing up, seeing themselves reflected in the TV shows that they're watching, here's hoping that that is what gives them that extra shot in the arm to move forward and, you know, demand those rights that they deserve and keep demanding them because they're still under an extreme amount of threat. So yeah, this is wonderful news.
And for the NAACP award, Star Trek Discovery was nominated for Outstanding Costume Design in Film or Television with their incredible team led by the amazing Gersha Phillips, incredible costume designer, and the rest of her team, Carly Nicodemo, Heather Constable, Christina Cattle, Cheryl Willock, and Becky McKinnon. So that's awesome. They're going up against Emancipation, The Woman King, Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, and A League of Their Own.
Wow.
So yeah, costume design. I think personally Wakanda Forever is going to be a tough contender there.
That'd be a toughie.
And so next, this is one of my favorite news stories to come out of this week because, so we've gotten several autobiographies over the past few years of various Star Trek characters. We've had Kirk, we've had Picard, we've had Janeway and Spock. And now we are getting the autobiography of Benjamin Sisko, The Life of Starfleet's Legendary Captain and Emissary, written, of course, by the man himself, Benjamin Sisko. It's an autobiography and edited by Derek Tyler Attico. And when I saw this announcement, Derek himself made it on social media. Yeah. I was so thrilled because he is absolutely the right person for this job. And I don't know the exact chain of events of how this all went there, but I remember there was a post like a year or two ago, somebody asked like, oh, if somebody was going to do Sisko's biography, who should do it? And I immediately in that post suggested Derek Tyler Attico and tagged him and he saw it and was like, oh, I would love to do that, blah, blah, blah.
So this is your doing?
I don't think so, but for whatever spark went out in the universe, I'm so glad that it came to be, regardless of how it came to be. That's exactly what I wanted to see. And I'm so, so happy for Derek. And I'm very excited.
100% full agreement. The first thing I thought in my head was, I read this headline, but did not know anything more about it. Just knew that there was going to be a Cisco book and I was great. And I'm like, oh, you know, let's hope, like, at the very least, let's hope they get a black author to do this, because they're going to be able to capture that cultural vibe that Avery Brooks was able to bring with mm-hmm. everything. And I was like, oh, goodness, oh, no. And then I just quickly looked and I'm like, Derek Tyler Attico, we're good, everybody. I'm so excited.
Yep, absolutely.
Like, perfect man for the job. Absolutely perfect. I can't wait to read this. Yeah, no, this is getting bumped up the list. I'm gonna read this one right away.
Excellent. Well, yeah, Derek Tyler Attico, a two-time winner of the Strange New Worlds writing contest, the short story contest. The first story of his, I think it was in number 8, was called Alpha and Omega, and it is just a mind-blowing story about, I can't even tell you what it's about. You need to go read that story. And then in the Strange New Worlds 2016 edition that came out, the ebook, he won for a story about Benny Russell, which when I read that, I was like, that's the man that needs to do the autobiography of Benjamin Sisko. And here we are. Yay. I'm so, like, you can hear the giddiness in my voice. I'm so excited. Oh,
the story of Benny Russell is the compendium to Far Beyond the Stars to me. It's an extremely visceral portrayal, something that myself as a white settler could never possibly experience, but it definitely gives me even just a fragment of context and a background to ensure that you know, I'm always going to be looking at things through that critical lens to push more of an empathetic outlook. And something that is important about all this is that kind of anti-racist sentiment that comes from the story of Benjamin Sisko. So I'm really excited to see this.
Yeah, and we'll be covering that for sure on an upcoming episode of the Positively Trek Book Club, and hopefully talking to Derek Tyler Attico himself about it. So I'm very excited.
If that happens, I will buy you a pizza if I can be on it.
Oh, yeah, done.
Okay, good. All right, there you go.
Not just for the pizza.
A verbal contract is legally binding.
Excellent. Well, our final piece of news this week is just a small story I wanted to touch on because, of course, one of the big things in Star Trek merchandising and fandom last year was the end of Eagle Moss and the official Starships collection and all of their other kind of things they had their fingers in as far as the build the Enterprise thing and all that stuff. So we've had some news on that. There's a company called D'Agostini Collectibles, which may be a name familiar to Star Trek fans. They have a line of products called Fan Home, which will be taking over the Build the Enterprise D program. According to Ben Robinson, fans should be able to pick up wherever they left off. Hopefully that all kind of comes together. It sounds like that's going on with pricing close to the original pricing that was offered before. I myself never got into the Build the Enterprise D thing, but there are a lot of fans out there with, you know, partially built Enterprises that were kind of left hanging. So glad to see that something's being done with that and that those fans will likely be seeing satisfaction for that.
Here's hoping. The demise of Eagle Moss was jarring and abrupt, to say the least. And also, I wondered, you know, like, being a person who teaches economics and stuff like that, there is the concept of use, exchange, and sign value. And sometimes that use value and exchange value get outpaced by the sign value of something. And when you're building commodities in our case, a neoliberal capitalist system, you're going to need to cut a profit. And if you're not cutting a reasonable profit, you will lose shareholders and you will lose all those other things that can keep your business going. So I'm not going to say necessarily that's precisely what happened to Eagle Moss, but obviously a lot of confidence was lost in that company extremely quickly, and now it's gone. And as much as we Star Trek fans aren't buying ships every single day, it was nice to be able to just pop on a website and be like, I want the Bozeman, and be able to find it, or to subscribe to something and get sort of that jolt of excitement to be able to see those ships and get the different sizes in them. And obviously they become good conversation pieces. I've got a number in my office. So I guess it's nice to see something coming of this.
And with regards to the Star Trek Starships collection as well, there is another group, Master Replicas, that have apparently taken the stock from Eagle Moss and will be selling those ships as well. So those will find their way into collectors' hands. No word on anybody taking up the mantle for creating new ships yet. That might still happen. I don't know. I think Eagle Moss was a very singular thing in Star Trek merchandise history, and I don't expect to quite see its like again, but I may be surprised. You never know.
I just wonder where the mold plates are for the ships. What company has those? What holding, you know, I mean, I would suspect possibly a factory in one of the special economic regions in the People's Republic of China would likely have some of those molds. So would it be possible, yeah, for a company to get enough interest to do a maybe more of a limited run of those models and get a certain amount of interest and maybe not try to reach the same heights as Eagle Moss was trying to reach. I think they were really trying to just go and go and get higher and higher. And I think they kind of blew up like a firework. So something a little more slow and sustained might be the way to go in terms of business model. That might not make things as affordable, but who knows?
Yeah. And I mean, we may not get things like a Zindi insectoid ship. But you know, there's so many specialized things they did. I can't see that quite happening again. I remember being shocked at some of the, like, I have the Hollow ship from Star Trek Insurrection, and I love it, but why okay, cool.
They flew a little too close to the sun. They were getting pretty specific.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. But there was a market for it. I don't know if that market is still there or what, but I don't know. Anyway, I'm not in that business, so I can't really say. But excited that that stock that they have will find its way into collectors' hands. And there's still hope that someone might take over creating new models. So you never know. Well, on that note, let's take a brief break and we'll come back and talk Star Trek Prodigy. This episode of Positively Trek would not be possible without the support of those of you who have gone to patreon.com/positivelytrek and signed up to become a Patreon supporter of the show. Thank you all so very much for your donations. They truly do help bring this show to you each week. Thank you especially to our Constitution class supporters, Joyce Marin, Jim Stoffel, Jesse Earle, Dave Garcia, Rick Young, and Paul D. Kinnear. If you'd like to become a supporter of the show, go to patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can get perks such as early access to episodes, ad-free versions of episodes, exclusive content, shoutouts, associate producer credits, and much more. Once again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you all once again. And now, let's get back to the show. So last flagship episode, we were talking Star Trek Prodigy, and the conversation just became too big for that episode. So here's the spilling over into another episode talking about Prodigy, which I'm really glad we decided to do that, because I feel like this show deserves a double episode, because just on the face of it, it's double the number of episodes that most seasons of Star Trek have been getting in the last few years. So kind of makes sense.
I think so. And I think it deserves a little bit more of a conversation. And I honestly don't think we're going to get to literally everything this time around either, to be perfectly honest with you, Dan. Just even thinking about what we've got written here kind of just sort of obliquely on the notes. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. So I think we just dive right back in from where we left off last time. I think we were kind of getting into the characters and whatnot was the last piece.
Yeah, we kind of did a pretty good overview of all of the characters. And I think we were kind of wanting to get into more of the story of the season and the overview of the whole series and
right.
kind of our thoughts on season one and stuff. So I see you've got here kind of a topic about the overall writing of the season with this kind of season-wide setup. Why don't you go into a little bit about that, about what you're interested in there?
Yeah, so I think what I really liked about this, and I don't know if you wrote that or I wrote that, but the whole story has a series of phases. And I can kind of locate those phases to what condition Murph is in, but sort of.
It's like TNG. Does Riker have the beard or not? Are they wearing the jumpsuits or not?
Does Murph have limbs? But it is kind of it's a several different stories very well meshed together, or at least they kind of intertwine with one another. And I find the culmination works well. I think the story writing really tried to be ambitious, I think, in the most part. And I think they sacrifice scientific accuracy in certain places, yet also still trying to really kind of get kids to think about how time works, right? Is the one big thing that I really appreciate is, do you think we've seen the last of the Diviner by any stretch of the imagination, Dan?
Oh, heavens no.
No. Right? Like, we're going to see a younger form of him for sure. And spoiler alert, I forgot to mention that. Anyways, I would imagine that if you're on part two of this episode, you've already realized that we are going roughshod through all spoilers whatsoever. So
absolutely, yeah.
I think that there were plot points that kind of came and went really fast. Forgive me, my accuracy isn't exactly perfect, but when Dal has that implant where he can start accessing some of his genetic traits, but it's like abandoned like seconds later. Like, I think in that respect, maybe what they're trying to do is just give a precedent for something that we'll return to later. But there was a lot of freneticness and franticness that I found that kind of tumbled the ending a little bit. Not really a critique. There was a lot of sort of kid show, like, again, Murph, like, accidentally shooting at Starfleet to kind of postpone any chance of real explanation until later on kind of thing. I think that there were some kind of tropey pieces. Again, kind of you and I were talking about how the Diviner is kind of a Darth Vader-y guy a little bit, the way he sacrifices himself ultimately for the love of his child rather than what, you know, the purpose he's serving, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I'm really just trying to fly through a number of things. It's still a kid's show, but I wanted to maybe also talk a little bit about that ending and just the amount of carnage would have had to have happened. And then maybe we can, we'll get into other things and what that might mean for us later. But back to the writing, I think though they cover so much space and so much time, I think that when you go back to the entirety of the show from beginning to end, it's a very complicated plot that I think really challenges the mind of a young person if they were to watch it, in terms of characterization, in terms of the way people are, in the fact that humans really aren't the center of this story. It's nothing like the bird episode on Lower Decks, but it is a very high concept story arc and idea altogether, right? Even the fact that, like, at the first point I was like, oh, isn't that cute, there's a holographic Janeway, la 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 la, and then actual Janeway shows up and they it's this whole thing, right? That is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you've made a lot of really, really great points there. I love the idea that this show challenges its viewers. You know, it could be something that really plays it safe and really handholds the watcher through everything. But I think they've done a really good job of actually crafting a dynamic story that, like you say, has some tropey bits, has some allowances for a younger audience. But at the same time, these characters are dynamic. They're changing from episode to episode. Yeah. They're going through some real stuff and coming out the other side having grown, which, again, like, not to keep harping on this point, but as someone who grew up in the 80s and 90s, I am not used to that. as far as a kids show goes. Like, I mean, there were some great kids shows on when I was a kid, but not really in this same vein, or at least none of the shows that I watched. You know, I watched Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and The Real Ghostbusters, and that was just, you know, what are they going up against this week? What quips is Peter Venkman going to make about this situation? You know, it was very much just kind of rote. Great stories, great acting and all that stuff, but you could watch an episode in season 4 and then an episode in season 2 and you would have no idea that, you know, the one you watched first actually came 2 years after the other one. This series, there's no way that you could do that without the context of where that episode takes place, and that's just one season.
Again, it's not unique or new necessarily. I mean, I think Rock's story and the kind of the premise behind the story of Shrek are very similar to one another. Mm-hmm. That the monster is in fact and can sometimes be the hero. You just need to get to know them a little bit better. And sometimes if they're going to be prickly or you know, evasive or standoffish about something, maybe it's because of the fact that they are very aware of what they're quote unquote supposed to be and what they're quote unquote supposed to be doing. I really like that because I think there's a lot of kids sometimes that really feel like they're getting pigeonholed into a specific thing. And I mean, some kids own that and become, you know, make that part of their identity. But I do see young people who try to push against that and explore a little bit more about who they are and see maybe what could be a stereotypical or very visible aspect of them to be something more than that. Mm-hmm. I guess like you can kind of look at the concept of Encanto too, if you've seen that Disney movie. Yeah. And the oldest sister, the one who can lift everything, right? She's far more than that.
Yeah.
Than what she's sort of characterized. Yeah, Luisa, thank you. What she's characterized to be. I forget even what we were talking about. It's just interesting to kind of like delve into how these characters have been put together. And yeah, I guess the way they challenge young people, like there's points that I don't like Doll, right? Like he makes some really bad choices in certain cases and kind of has to live with those. And the fact that we have, you know, not really a redemption arc for him, but sort of like a, you're not going to be in Starfleet, but that doesn't mean you're not going to be a part of Starfleet. And the fact that he has to really come to terms with that up to the very, very end of this whole experience, because that's what I'm going to call the last episodes. They're just sort of a big experience. I found that so much happens and a lot of tables get turned very quickly. And like I said, Dan, do you think a lot of people died in that last big kind of thing?
Yeah, that's something I wanted to talk about, because that's one thing that, I mean, the show deals with a lot of heavy stuff with the kids at the start being what a certain character in Thor Ragnarok would call prisoners with jobs.
Yeah.
Which is one of my new favorite euphemisms. But, you know, so there's heavy stuff and there's obviously mistreatments and obviously there's death, but it's not really focused on. And then, yeah, you get to the end of the series and, you know, credit to the show, they could have just shown the ships from the outside and, you know, made it very hands off. But there were a few shots where they show like people inside the ships and, you know, walls kind of exploding and things happening around them. And yeah, like a lot of people died. There's a lot of destroyed ships at the end, not just disabled ships or ships with some damage. No, there's like warp nacelles and parts of hull floating by.
Yeah, it's another Wolf 359. And to kind of put that into a bit of perspective, there is the lightning in a bottle gigantic toy commercial known as the Transformers animated movie that starts with, for me, what was a terrifying scene when Unicron comes and eats that planet of robots, and you got the children playing and that like coming, and he comes and just starts eating this planet, and people are getting sucked in, and people are screaming and crying, and you see them getting like digested and chomped up, and like it's a very moving scene for me as a very young person. I would actually sometimes, when I was really little, get my mom to fast forward past it because I couldn't take that scene, and I wonder how a young person would handle it to some degree, because you know, though, of course, in the Transformers movie, you don't really necessarily see a robot, one of the little robot people get, like, specifically, like, eviscerated by Unicron. You can do the math, and I think it's the same way here. And, yeah, you're right, the show does an extremely good job of how they approach a disastrous moment like that, but it doesn't take away the reality of it.
Yeah, it's given appropriate weight, I think.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just like, oh, this is a problem we have to overcome. What's going on here? It's like they're looking at what's happening and realizing that
it's really bad.
Yeah. And for better or for worse, like, however much blame you want to assign to anybody, certainly they feel that they have brought this horrific event to Starfleet's door, and they have to do something about it. And that's given, like I say, the weight I think it deserves. Like, I really appreciate that you can see it on their faces, that they know that horrific things are happening. And on some level, maybe it's not because of them. They're not the ones that have maliciously done this. But if it weren't for them, this might not be happening in this way right now, kind of thing.
Also, the way in which things break down, Starfleet really does hang its hat on some technological constants, right? If you're in a gigantic ship in space moving in a form of faster than light travel, a lot of things need to be accounted for. There's a whole spectrum of responsibility, shall we say, to doing that and operating such a complicated piece of technology in space. And for those things to break down, even to the level of a universal translator, for me, is just terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the sun will belch a solar flare towards Earth, and it can actually affect electronic systems, all that sort of stuff. And that's always kind of a fearful thing. And then, of course, you understand that, like, different types of nuclear blasts and hybridized nuclear blasts as, like, conventional weaponry can even do that to, say, like, a city or something like that. Did you hear about that? I forget what had happened. There was some kind of natural disaster. I think it was an earthquake in China. And a plane, they basically flew a Wi-Fi plane over top of the city 24/7, switching out planes, just to broadcast internet signal down so that people could help each other and,
wow,
you know, communicate with one another. And that there's precedent for that in other countries as well. I just remember reading that because a student was doing some kind of project, I can't remember, on telecommunication. And that was something that they brought up. And I just thought, like, you know, why don't we hear more about that? About, like, what happens if the lights go out, especially here at, like, minus 40, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as someone who's looked into things like supply chains and stuff, and where we live, like, we're pretty far north, and this is the case for our city, but it's also not just limited to remoter places. It's also a constant for everywhere. If the trucks don't run for one day, that city will run out of food. That's how our supply chains work. Like, that's not, we've sacrificed, yeah. Sorry, this is almost like a total tangent and rant here, but we have completely sacrificed the robustness of these things for the convenience of them. And
yeah,
it's scary. Like, and it's obviously something that is very much on a lot of people's minds and in media and in pop culture. I mean, Nikki and I have just started watching The Last of Us, and that is terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, well, that's why we find those kinds of stories so compelling. It's it's scary, and it's very real and possible. I mean, the early days of the COVID pandemic, I mean, we weren't sure where things were going to go. It could have easily gone. One ship gets stuck sideways in the Suez Canal. You know? You get a perfect storm of three different things happening, and all of a sudden, the world's running out of microchips or something. You know, it's wild.
Well, and what you're referencing is just in time infrastructure. It's how our medical system works. Mm-hmm. Definitely a lot of our commodity and food infrastructure is based on that just in time. So you're right. If things stop briefly, they can really have a lasting and larger effect on the supply of other things. And so back to it is just the fact that the way in which that weapon was utilized was to create a cascading phenomenon, right, of failures. And to think about that is very scary, because I think to some degree, you know, we have that much in common with the Federation and Starfleet that we've really put our chips in on the way our technology works. And if there was some kind of cascading failure, it would be big. It would be really big.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And one thing that kind of fascinated me too about this is the entity that brought this about, or the construct that brought this about,
the living construct.
The living construct, yeah. And I find myself thinking, like, the writers are of modern Star Trek are very frightened of AI, or feel that there's a lot to talk about with regards to AI, which they're not wrong, first of all. I think there's a lot of things to be very wary about. I think of, you know, my household and my wife, her livelihood relies upon creativity and artistic works. And now all of a sudden we have AI art, which there's a lot of artists out there going like, excuse me. But what is this fascination with AI bringing about the end of everything? Because we've got the living construct in Prodigy. We had the Section 31 control kind of trying to get its hands on the sphere data to end all of life in season 2 of Discovery. And we had the kind of Lovecraftian AI nightmare at the end of Picard season 1. Like, this definitely seems to be something that's very much on the minds of a lot of modern Trek writers.
Well, I would say that this is actually a pedigree of Trek writers, right? You go back to Nomad and V'ger. Mm-hmm. You definitely have a precedent for this idea of an AI that is kind of interested in annihilating its creator / it has some kind of bone to pick with us. And I think if we're going to get in the weeds here, I think there's a philosophical aspect to this, in the sense that what we fear is that AI is not necessarily just going to see us as some pathetic, you know, being worthy of kind of pity or whatever else, but see that nature within us to destroy and to take over and to enslave and do all these terrible things. And I think it's a little bit telling in that respect of what backgrounds the people who are making the AI have, because I think it does sort of preclude the idea that if AI is created by people with, you know, backgrounds towards that sort of thinking, then that's how the AI is going to act. Because I guess, like, for me, I read a really interesting book by a guy by the name of Greg Graffin a ways back called Population Wars, and he basically talks about how the concept of survival of the fittest is not even really something that most zoologists and biologists really even think with anymore. It's about symbiotics. It's about incorporation. The idea that within our genetic code we have in a large amount of basically fossilized viruses that so in included themselves within us that we've just basically fully incorporated. And the idea that it's through the symbiosis of different species that entire ecosystems are held up. And so sometimes I think that maybe what that really is the writers looking at what artificial intelligence could potentially do based on what we could see in our darker elements. But what for me is saying, like, could AI also instead say, no, I am actually still going to use a form of force, but in this respect, I'm going to make sure that this force is to force people to work together more readily and all that sort of stuff. So you're right. There's definitely a precedent for AI bad, AI scary. I don't know. I think it depends on how you program it.
Yeah, it's interesting. And your point about past Star Trek as well, dabbling in this. I mean, you could even look at Lore and the Borg. Like, And that final point you made, AI forcing people to cooperate and work together, is that the Borg? Like, that sounds, that could be the Borg. Like, could be something that feels very or sounds very altruistic. And in the case of the Borg, if you look at it from their perspective, they're bringing order to chaos, right? There's all these chaotic species. Let's bring them all under our aegis and have them work towards the common goal of perfection.
Well, but also, like, hasn't the Borg and the Federation often been compared as sort of like the polar opposites of one another, mm-hmm. or like two sides of the same coin, in the sense that, like, to some, you know, the Borg and the Federation really aren't very different at all. The Federation just decorates itself with all this culture. Mm-hmm. The Borg do away with it for the sake of efficiency, right?
Mr. Eddington, I see.
Yeah, thank you. I guess for me, yeah, it definitely treads on some regular tropes like we've seen before, but I think it's utilized in a slightly different way. It actually kind of reminds me of what they were planning to do to Hugh with the Borg, mm-hmm. right? Just like complicate all the programs to the point that they become redundant and destroy themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah, the kind of reverse of that. That's interesting. I like that comparison for sure. So yeah, a new Wolf 359 for Starfleet, it looks like here. I'd be interested to see if there's any kind of follow-up on this or any kind of mention of it. I mean, we know that the Enterprise E was there, at least a ship mm-hmm. that had that on the nacelle. It had a different registry on the front, but we'll just ignore that. The Defiant was there, the USS Defiant. So, you know, there's some big players here, or at least some former big players on the scene. So this was a big event for Starfleet, I think. Well, one topic you have on here that I want to dive into. We talked a lot about the characters last episode, but I love this idea. What character do you most relate to? And I think there's a lot of value in that discussion because, like I kind of said last episode, each of them have traits here and there that you kind of recognize in yourself, or one recognizes in oneself watching the show. And I think, you know, very much on purpose, very much meaning to connect with an audience and provide them with examples or, you know, lessons taught via people who are maybe like the viewer going through some life-changing situation. So what character, Barry, do you most relate to in Star Trek Prodigy?
Yeah, and it changed. Mm-hmm. Initially it was Dahl. I kind of really sort of had this like super soft spot for Rock for a while, but I finished off by saying Zero, and it had to do with all those like kind of cool little bit of backstories you get, right? Kind of in the chaos and calamity of those last seasonal episodes, kind of getting that, having seeing those characters now with their backstories intact really helped kind of flesh out a lot about them. And, you know, more than meets the eye, to kind of go back to Transformers again, is kind of the big thing about all of them is they are all very dynamic, flawed. I like Zero probably the most, mainly just because it really does sort of show me like I know Zero is actually a being, but by having a corporeal form, it's sort of like a living embodiment of a being with a soul to me in some cases. Mm. I like the fact that they do away with any kind of concept of gender. How can you be a gender in that respect? I think that's really neat. And I think that helps young people to think of it as that concept, right? They bend gender and they bend time in this, and both things are human constructs capable of bending, which I think is really fascinating. So I think that's really a big piece of it, but also like Zero's just kind of obsessive interests. I typically get obsessive interests. I was telling you before we started, I listened to a lecture this morning just for like recreational purposes and wrote 5 pages of notes. So yeah, that's kind of where I would go. How about yourself?
I very much agree with a lot of what you said. There's a lot of various traits among the characters that at one point or another, I'm kind of like, oh, I've gone through that. I've been misunderstood like that. I've hidden how I really feel about things and taken out my aggression in private, like Jenkum Pog did, and Dal and his kind of wanting to switch off and tune out rather than confront some thing that's happening that needs his attention and stuff. Ultimately, I'm kind of going to be a bit boring and say for myself, it's Zero as well. And earlier in the show, during the news segment, I was talking about how Tendi really, like I really connect with Tendi because of the passion and enthusiasm. And I see those same qualities in Zero, peeking into every corner of the universe and just the awe with which they experience it. And then what solidified it for me, what locked it in place, was that holodeck episode where we see that they are engaging in this mystery solving club, and they go in there and try and solve mysteries and follow little clues. And I love that stuff. You know, murder mystery parties or escape rooms or, you know, just things where you really have to kind of analyze things and dive deep and look at things in new and different ways. I really Like, I was like, oh, I would be in there with Zero right alongside them solving these mysteries. I love that.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. And I mean, like, I don't want to necessarily say that other characters didn't strike me in certain ways. But yeah, Zero just really kind of stands out to me as the character. And your connection to Tendi, I hadn't even thought of. And now I'm like, thwap my forehead and duh. Absolutely. Yeah. It's that there's an unabashedness. There is an intentionality. A lot of people have really liked and clung on to like a character like Murph, right?
Mm.
Which I understand. I like Pog. I guess like Pog didn't really strike me as much as some of the other characters personally, but yeah, that's again, just sort of a personal thing. And like I said, Dahl actually I enjoyed because Dahl gave me something to dislike sometimes too. Like his character wasn't always the best. And I like Gwyn's story, and I think that's probably what we're going to see a lot more of next season. At least that's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into that then. So looking ahead to season two, what are we expecting to see? What would we like to see with these kids becoming warrant officers in training in Starfleet? They can't go to the academy, but they'll be training alongside Janeway on some ship, which I have theories about. But yeah, I don't know. What do you want to see in season two?
I don't want to see any main characters die, but I have a fear that one will.
That makes me sad. I don't want that.
Yeah. I think they might try to sacrifice a main character. And I don't know why I have that feeling other than just the way... Should I say anything? I don't know. Should I even like bring it into the world? I don't know. Anyway, let me just say, maybe I'll say it off mic later, then we can talk about it. But I have this weird prediction, and it just has a lot to do with the way the story went and everything else. And it would be within the tropes of a character who has done so much to kind of distance themselves from their stereotype, ultimately having to use their stereotype to save everybody else.
Ooh, interesting. Okay, we'll talk after.
Yeah.
I'm really curious. Like you say, I think Gwyn's story is going to play heavily into season two. Obviously, they're setting up that she's going out to kind of forestall this future from happening and stop this civil war on her planet. Like I said, warrant officers in training, we've got a bunch of young O'Briens, non-commissioned officers, or maybe acting ensigns like Wesley in season one and two and three of TNG or something like that. I don't know.
They're going to have their cake and eat it too, mm-hmm. right? You can't be in Starfleet, but you can be in Starfleet, but you can't be in Starfleet, but you can be in Starfleet. And I don't know. I guess like it's a kid's show and that's fine, but maybe not this time. Like, I don't know. Just make them officers. I would honestly say just whatever. It's okay. I'd mentioned a number of sort of like scientists and physicists and stuff like that. And was just mentioning to Dan about a possible idea for another episode. And there was one specific person named Jack Parsons, who was one of the founders of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He got kicked out of like formal training. Like he never had a degree or anything, but he knew how to build jets. You know, it's that kind of thing. So it's like, there are points and times when those funny little pieces of paper and those flaming hoops they get you to jump through to get them. Sometimes there is a possibility that someone can just be that good or go through a certain series of experiences. If I could tangent just for like a hot minute, it really actually kind of boils down to how we have knowledge about history and the land and everything like that, where you know, a scientist and a biologist is going to have a lot of extremely good points of view, ways to look at things. But that doesn't mean that we can't look at the viewpoints and perspectives and advice from, say, indigenous elders, right? They might not necessarily have a funny sheet of paper, but they have an amazing amount of knowledge from a group of people who sophisticatedly lived and managed the biosphere in this area for an extremely long period of time. So I do feel like there are times when funny pieces of paper and credentials can actually get in the way.
Yeah.
And that's coming from an educator's perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, that's O'Brien to a T as well.
Right?
You know, the everyman who just is an amazing engineer can turn rocks into replicators, right? As they say. I love that they're not in the academy and that they're going to be, you know, basically enlisted crewmen, which is, again, like a side of Starfleet we've not seen very much of. And I love the story of how that came about. David Mack, who worked as a consultant during season one of Prodigy, the original plan was they would get into the academy at the end of season one. And David Mack basically said, you know, think back to TNG and how hard it was for Wesley Crusher to get into the academy. He had to take this test and he didn't get in the first time, even though he aced pretty much everything. You know, these are spots in the academy that are really hard to get into. And the idea of just kind of ushering in this group ahead of what must be a kilometers long waiting list. We're in Canada and this is set in the future. it would be unfair. So they kind of played with the idea for a bit and decided on this kind of warrant officers in training thing, which had the added benefit of them not stepping on the toes of the still upcoming Starfleet Academy series as well, as they said. So that's kind of cool. I think it's neat. And it's a way to stretch the writers into doing something different, that rather than just, again, like this show does, it doesn't do the expected thing. It does something a little different. And I love that.
Yeah, I guess like more than anything, what I want to see is more risks being taken in the next season. Like they took risks, even if they don't fully land all the time. Like this hasn't been like a perfect series that's like, you know, I would personally say that the overall writing of Lower Decks has been my absolute favorite of all of the Star Trek currently in existence. That's not to say I didn't enjoy Prodigy. I have to say it's actually kind of bumped a few others in terms of my favorites now, mm-hmm. and is something that I want to watch with young people who I share my life with now and everything. I think that would be pretty cool. And I think it would be a very accessible way into Star Trek for them. I think what this show does is it gives an entry point that's accessible. It doesn't necessarily require you to really get into other Star Trek for the sake of it. But I think if you were to encounter an episode of Star Trek, I think you would be charmed by how much you would recognize. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to go into all the references. Lower Decks is also extremely good at just a constant barrage of little minor references here and there. But predictions moving ahead, I wonder if they're going to do something with the supernova and the destruction of Romulus.
That would be interesting. And something we've seen, you know, other Star Trek series that are currently airing kind of tie themselves to a little bit. So,
well, Keith D. Candido, I have to give credit to, is the author of a article on that. He's very critical of Prodigy. Otherwise, I didn't agree with a lot of what he had to say in terms of. He was quite critical of the writing and the acting and stuff like that, which is allowed. I just personally, if you want to read a critique, go to him. If you want to read something a little less than a negative critique, we're here and I definitely like this mm-hmm. way more than any of the little writing bits that I was like, oh, kids show. But that's the thing, is it's a kids show. So if you found some of the writing simplistic, it's because it's supposed to be accessible for people who are like 10. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I mean,
come on.
There's some things like they rounded the corners of the Borg a little bit and things like that. I mean, but it's a kids show, you know, that's fine.
Then you'd have to do the same math for Clone Wars, right? Mm-hmm. It was geared for a younger audience, so it's going to be a little more slapstick. It's going to be a little more whatever. Like, it's going to be a little more fun like that. So, yeah. So okay, don't worry about it.
Definitely.
Section 31 is coming. You'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll get all of your really dark, gritty stuff that, yeah, anyway. I'll close out, I guess, too, by saying, like, predictions for season two. I think this is going to become a totally different show than it was in season one, which is, you know, there's a reason it's not Star Trek Protostar. you know, the Protostar was blown up at the end of the season. That's not the focus of the show. And I love that, yeah, we're following these characters and they're not stuck in amber in a situation. You know, they're evolving and growing. And like I said last week, we're past the video game first stage tutorial part and we're into the real world now. They're going to be on a real Starfleet ship with real Starfleet rules. And I'm sure there's going to be some really interesting ways that they brush up against those, and we'll see some conflicts there and some growth for these characters in that way. You know, I'm not necessarily one for, you know, this solution. I'm not a militaristic person, but you know, there's that old trope of sending the troubled kid to military camp, right? I mean, I'm sure there's going to be Dal not waking up when he's supposed to at some point, and there's hilarity will ensue. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And this past season, I've gone on the record as saying a few times, especially towards the end of the season, it was nudging up into Deep Space Nine levels of enjoyment and appreciation for me, which is the highest praise I think I can give a Star Trek series, because the pedestal upon which I place Deep Space Nine is, has until this recently, has been unprecedented. And there are moments where I'm like, this is giving me those same vibes. And it might partially be because I didn't expect that of this show. So it surprised me enough that it did that. But, you know, I wasn't expecting to not enjoy the show by any stretch, but it certainly has exceeded my expectations.
If you have stuck with us this far through two parts of Positively Trek and you still haven't seen Star Trek Prodigy, definitely you would still really enjoy it, even though we've basically spoiled almost every plot point.
Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more there too that we haven't even touched on, I think.
There's some, yeah, I mean, like, for instance, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, this one really dives into the world of the Tellarites too, mm-hmm. and how they associate with each other and how they socialize and how they use nuances and cues and how some of those nuances and cues being done wrong actually help like make problems worse, you know, like, so yeah, absolutely. Like we could literally talk for another probably half an hour, 45 minutes, whatever else. So yeah, like, there's a lot to access here. There's a lot to enjoy. And I think I would probably put Prodigy in the top five of my favorite Star Trek series at this point. Definitely. Yeah, it would be in the top five. DS9 still rounding out the very, very top. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's up there.
Yeah. It's kind of like, for me, it's Deep Space Nine and then this kind of nebulous cloud of other Star Trek series, depending on how I'm feeling that day and whether I have indigestion or I'm bad at ranking stuff. Like, I'm just going to put that right out there. But yeah, it's there's been moments where it's approached that, and which has blown me away. So but yeah, I'll just end this by turning it to our audience, and I would love to hear from you. What did you think of Prodigy? Is there anything that you violently disagree with us about, or anything you want to say? Please reach out to us, positivelytrek@gmail.com. And also our Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook. You can make a comment there. There'll be a thread for this episode. We'd love to hear from you. I think hearing from the listeners is one of my favorite parts about doing this show. So, well, this has been a really fun discussion of Star Trek Prodigy. I think we've kind of discussed it from stem to stern, with still so much more to be said about it, I think. So it kind of blows me away how quickly an hour plus goes by talking about this stuff. So thank you, those of you who have stuck with us. And like Barry said, if you've gone this far and not seen the show, first of all, I question your life choices. But second of all, go watch it. It is well worth the viewing. So,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Worth a binge, too. I watched it feverishly while sick, and I put a lot of episodes together, and they really blend in my brain, but it was really fun. I loved it.
Yeah, I kind of want to go back and watch it again. I've just watched it, you know, a couple times each episode that came out, but still just as it aired. So I'd love to go back and start at the beginning and just go through the story again. Yeah, if I had all the time in the world, that would be great. Well, thank you all so much for listening. We will talk to you again in the next episode. Until then, As always, stay positive.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.